Welcome to University Matters on Campus FM. This is Patricia Camilleri, inviting you to discover what research, projects and events are taking place at the University of Malta. I'm very happy to have with me in the studio today for University Matters, Dr. Timothy Gambin. Just a word about my guest. Dr. Gambin is a senior lecturer in maritime archaeology in the Department of Classics and Archaeology here at the University of Malta. Over the past years, he's been involved in numerous collaborative research projects, including the PaleoMed project with the CNRS Aix-en-Provence, the Ancient Cisterns project with Calipol, USA, which interestingly explored underwater management through the use of small remote operating vehicles armed with a variety of sensors. And I watched this in action on a video, and it really looked fascinating. Together with the Aurora Trust, he directs numerous offshore underwater surveys in various parts of the Mediterranean, including Spain, Italy and Croatia. And he is currently editing a volume of essays related to the Maltese Islands and the sea. Today, he's with us to talk about the summer school, which was held recently here in Malta, a summer school in maritime archaeology, looking at a site at the Meliha Bay. Welcome, Dr. Gambin.
Good morning.
This was a fascinating summer school. I saw a video clip of you bouncing around on the water, being interviewed about it, and it really did look very interesting. Obviously, you don't start a summer school just by getting up one morning and deciding to do it. It does take some time, some years, I would imagine, to actually gather all the people together and the information. How did you manage to do it with this summer school?
Well, the first thing we needed to do was to identify a site. And rather than looking for a new site to work on, we decided to look back into the archives and see whether it was feasible to explore an underwater archaeological site that had already been looked into. There were two main exploration projects in the past. One was carried out in the late 1950s and 1960s in Schlendi Bay, and the other one was carried out in 1967 by Honor Frost in Meliha Bay. Given the geography of the Meliha Bay site and the fact that Honor Frost only worked one season, we decided that it would be better to go for Meliha Bay. So 2 years ago, we managed to get some funding and started a remote sensing project using various tools, including side scan sonar, sub button profile, and a magnetometer. In a nutshell, what these tools do is they enable us to identify the presence or absence of archaeological objects within the seabed, so objects that are buried in the sand. The results were interesting. In the subsequent year, that's September of last year, 2012, we put together a small dive team and went to look to see whether we could identify the site, the actual site where Honor Frost worked, which we did. And the second objective of the 2012 survey was to identify whether there was any material present on the seabed within this site, whether there was enough material to organize a project on the back of which we could organize this field school.
How much did you know about the site already from the research that Honor Frost did in, I think you said, 1967?
Well, we knew quite a lot because, for two reasons. Honor Frost was a meticulous note taker and very good with her illustrations, mapping skills and so on. And all of her archive is deposited at the National Museum of Archaeology. So we had the opportunity to visit her plans, visit her object drawings and so on. She was a very good artist. But together with the Golcha Foundation, and Captain Golcha was one of the prime movers of underwater archaeology in the 1960s, he actually set up the Malta Underwater Archaeological Research Group, which formed part of a broader research group based in Sicily, but with the focus on the entire Mediterranean. Anyway, Anna Frost, through the Golcha Foundation, actually published her research work within a year or year and a half of her project, which, even by today's standards, that's very, very good. And the quality of the report left us in no doubt as to A, the quality of her work, but B, also she places this report in the context of preparation work. She actually states in this small publication, look, what we've done is we've prepared the site for future generations to work on.
That was a very avant-garde attitude, perhaps, at the beginning of the new archaeology era, really.
Very much so. But then when you consider that Anna Frost was a woman working in the 1960s, working in a field which was very much a man's domain, not only underwater archaeology, but diving in general. In fact, she here, her team consisted solely of military divers. So there was this one woman leading a team of X amount of military divers, and I can really imagine sort of her barking commands and getting them all to do what she wanted to do, because she was a formidable woman.
Yeah, she must have been quite a lady.
In fact, over 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to visit her on a couple of occasions, because she kept a house in Malta, and she gave me a 4 pieces of glass frit which she had lifted, which she had excavated from the site, together with a copy of her book, because she was always scolding me for going off and carrying out new survey projects here, there and everywhere. And she used to tell me, look, but you have this site right on your doorstep. This merits study just as much as finding new sites. And in the copy of her book, she put the inscription, I hope you studied this first. So in a way, these 3 years have been a fulfillment of a promise, perhaps late, but better late than never.
And obviously, we're lucky now to have you as a PhD in maritime archaeology, working at the University of Malta. But to do a summer school like this, one would need more people, more human resources. And I know that you had Professor Jeremy Green with you. How did he fit into the summer school?
Let's take a step back. Up until 8-9 years ago, we would struggle to find opportunities, not only for myself, but also for up-and-coming students, to participate in similar projects. And when I say opportunities, I don't mean locally, because locally there were very few and far in between. I mean overseas. So through the University of Malta, myself, students, but also members from the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage, went overseas, places like Spain, France, even Algeria, for opportunities to excavate. What is nice now, and I feel a sense of pride that sort of the university has backed this this field, is that we are now in a position, we have built up enough experience in the field, and put ourselves in a position where we can welcome people to actually come and get that experience here. Obviously, no man is an island, and I think the sharing of people's experiences, especially somebody like Jeremy Green, who has been excavating underwater since the late 1960s, he is indeed one of the pioneers of underwater archaeology. So it was an honor, it was an asset to have him here, not only for myself, I think especially for the participants, to spend 2 weeks rubbing shoulders with Jeremy Green on a day-to-day basis. It's not just the experience you get working with him underwater, but also the little anecdotes and the little tips that he gives. You know, he's a fantastic guy who is always willing to share, and always willing to, he's not set in his ways, he's always willing to explore new ways of technology. So we were very lucky that through the University of Malta and the Australian High Commissioner, we were very lucky to get their backing in order to have Jeremy Green with us. So, together with funds from the Anna Frost Foundation and backing from the University and the Australian High Commission, we were able to get Jeremy Green to participate in this field school.
So, turning to the actual logistics of the summer school itself, the field school experience, I would imagine, would be a critical component for any student pursuing or thinking of pursuing a career in underwater archaeology, that mix of academic instruction, hands-on underwater archaeology research. What, in fact, are the main aims of a summer school of this nature, which lasted, what?
3 weeks.
3 weeks. Both for the students and, of course, for the academics involved on the research point of view.
Well, when we decided to apply for funding from the Honor Frost Foundation, I think that just to simply ask for money and for an excavation, it just becomes any other project. We felt strongly that we could use this project to train up-and-coming people who work in this field. So the idea of applying for funds from the HFF, from the Honor Frost Foundation, was simply to create this field school and bring over people from disadvantaged countries in the Mediterranean in order to get the experience. Now, in the past, I have seen, and indeed I participated in one field school, whereby a kind of fake site was set up in order to practice certain skills. Whereas we did pick up the skills, on the other hand, sort of the sense of satisfaction is not quite there. So we wanted to give these participants, both from the disadvantaged countries of the Mediterranean and others, the experience of working on a real site. So if you're excavating and you're recording an actual piece of Roman pottery coming up from the, you know, where it's lain for over 1,700 years, and so on. So the idea of working on a real site gives them real experience and real responsibilities. The main aim of the field school towards the students is to give them an experience so that they get exposure to nearly everything, because they went here for the build-up, so all the logistics with regard to applying for the permit and so on and so forth, they didn't get to see that. But I wanted them to see what it entails, putting the raft together, taking the raft out on the site, mooring the raft, setting up the pump to excavate and so on, to dismantling the site towards the very end, also with first aid and conservation, the desalination process of the objects and so on. We even had drawing lessons, so for those that didn't have much exposure to the drawing of archaeological objects, we had somebody from Heritage Malta coming over to give sort of an introduction to archaeological illustration. Why did we want to do this? So that if or when rather one of these participants goes back to their country and participates or initiates a similar project, we hope to have given them the right exposure and the right experience in the field, so that they'll be able to say, ah, in Malta we made a raft this way, here we might have to modify it, but they will have the basis of what is needed, etc., the whole logistical background to you know, that goes and to support a project.
And for you as an academic, at the end of the day,
we had our research aims, which we actually did share with the students. They knew what we wanted to achieve. Primarily, we wanted to map the objects that we noted in September 2012. So, in September 2012, when we identified the site, we realized that there were still some objects on the surface. So we wanted to map those, label them, and also raise them, obviously with the permit issued through the Superintendence of Cultural Heritage. And we wanted to explore certain areas within the zone explored by Honor Frost in 67 to determine whether any objects were left behind. So besides picking up the surface of mapping and picking up the surface objects, we placed a 2 meter by 2 meter grid and excavated down to bedrock to check whether the area that she explored is sterile or not. And for the most, it was relatively sterile. So it seems that the area that she has studied has been now completely cleared of objects.
This is University Matters on Campus FM, and I'm Patricia Camilleri. Today I'm joined by Dr. Timmy Gambin from the University's Department of Classics and Archaeology to discuss the Maritime Archaeology Summer School that took place earlier this year. And we're talking about skills here. We've mentioned drawing skills and creating these grids and various other things that you need to know. Also, you mentioned the machinery, the technology that is now commonplace or needed in a modern excavation. The maritime archaeologists of 1960 probably needed certain skills. The maritime archaeologist of 2013 maybe needs different skills or more skills. How much does he or she have to be a scientist, for example?
This is an interesting question, because the very epitome of this notion of the evolution of the underwater archaeologist is Jeremy Green himself, who got into the field of underwater archaeology to test handheld magnetometers and metal detectors, working in Turkey with people like George Bass and so on, and working in Cyprus too. And then today, I thought that we were going to have a traditionalist joining us, and he had this digital camera, and his baby now is taking a series of digital photographs, and using these digital photographs, putting them into this very, not complex, but it looks complex to use, software, and generating 3D images of the site and certain specifics within the site. So this shows how, in order to maintain, to keep up with the times, you actually need to keep up with technology. And there is a reason behind this. The financial crisis has hit everybody, not least the humanities. So how does this translate to our field? Less funding means less time on the water. I would have loved to spend 6 weeks, but 3 weeks was sort of what we could sustain with the amount of backing that we had. But in 3 weeks, I still wanted to achieve what I would have wanted to achieve in 6 weeks. So this is where digital photography comes in over analog photography. This is where photogrammetry and the creation of these 3D maps comes, you know, takes priority over traditional mapping skills. We still taught the traditional mapping skills, but we made sure that the students also got exposure to this 3D photography.
Can you describe the site? We've mentioned that it's a Roman site, a bit en passant. What does the site look like today?
Well, anybody who has gone snorkeling in Meleha Bay will vouch for this. Meleha Bay, the seabed in Meleha Bay, is formed either by sand, patches of sand, or further out, patches of sand intermingled with large Posidonia meadows. Posidonia oceanica, which we know in Maltese as alka, or Neptune's seagrass, is protected. It is protected at EU level. Why is it protected? I won't go into too much detail, but it's a great bioindicator and also very much an integral part of our ecosystem underwater. Despite this and the protection that's afforded to it through local and European legislation, vessels still anchor there, so they not only destroy the Posidonia, but also possibly destroy sites that may be buried. Anyway, to describe the site, the main area that Onnefrost worked in 1967 consisted of a large grassy patch, which measures in relative, it looks a bit like an S shape, a stretched S, which measures about 60 meters in length. So we were working in that area. To the east is flat Posidonia growing on grass, and to the west is Posidonia growing on mat, which means Posidonia growing on itself. There's a cliff which rises about 5 meters. I'm not convinced that we've seen everything related to the site. I think there's more, but we'll have to wait till next year and to look at the various results that we've gathered over the past 3 years to see where the next place is that we should look for the bulk of the site.
The ship itself, have you any idea what type of ship it was, what it might have been carrying, or even why it may have gone down?
Why it went down is probably the easiest answer to the question. The easiest question to answer, rather. I'm not one who generally speculates. However, this is a practically easy one because there's a reef about 100 meters towards the northeast, and one can easily imagine, even on a frost road, this in her publication, a Grigal blowing the ship onto the reef, and then the ship sort of foundering and breaking up. This same Grigal, the northeasterly storm, creates a high energy situation within Meliha Bay every winter. So what would have happened to the ship over the centuries that the cargo would have broken up. So it's not a typical ancient shipwreck, which is a sort of a homogeneous pile of amphoras or ceramics. This is broken up and spread over a wide area. In fact, many of the objects that we're finding are rounded, which means that the objects have moved along the seabed, and in the process of moving along the seabed, their edges have become rounded and scoured. Again, I think that the bulk of the cargo, and I'll come back to the contents in a few seconds, is still buried somewhere, either under the sand or under the alga, under the seagrass. We can date the shipwreck from the type of pottery to between 200 and 250 AD, so to the 3rd century. It was probably sailing from the eastern Mediterranean. The amphora types are from Greece. We can tell that from the shape. There seem to be some objects from Syria. And this year, very interestingly, we picked up what looks like a pendant. As I said, the objects are well worn, but together with Professor Bonanno from our department, it seems like this is a pendant with a dedication to Sol Invictus, which is a cult that really came to the fore in the 3rd century AD through Emperor Aurelian. So we're actually looking at a personal object which can really shed light on the nature of the crew of this ship.
What about the pros and cons of excavation? It's always a bit of a thorny question, this. Archaeologists, I think, are very ready to admit that excavation is, of its nature, destructive. As a maritime archaeologist, how do you look at underwater excavations?
Well, it's a bit of a double-edged sword. If you look at it in the context of this field school, I think that the benefits of what we just did outweigh the negatives. Why? Because we're training people, we're training future generations, we're looking at objects that, despite the first sort of option, as said by UNESCO, which is to preserve in situ, these objects are in a high energy zone and therefore are eroding at a quick rate. So I would say that what we've done so far is very much in line with sort of a positive outlook towards excavation, with positive results. It can tell us a lot about sites in Malta. Even the next steps, even if we do excavate and find well-preserved parts of cargo, that in itself will tell us, look, if we have this in Meliha Bay, then we have most of our bays, except for the two harbours of the Grand Harbour and Marsa Amshe, most of our bays are covered in Posidonia. So all of a sudden we can say, all right, if we do have sites, A, we can go out and look for them with the same technology that we used in Meliha. So we're using sort of this as a test. I'm saying remote sensing. And B, we know that they're well preserved, that if there are sites, they are well preserved and they are protected from looters through these layers of Posidonia and sand. Therefore, let's broaden our strategy and say, look, therefore anchoring or the illegal throwing of mooring blocks must stop, because not only are we damaging a protected species, which is this Neptune seagrass, but we're also potentially exposing and damaging archaeology. So all of a sudden you have the marine biologists and the marine archaeologists working together for the common good. So a little excavation, okay, in this point in time can go a long way with regard to a long-term strategy.
And What about future excavation? I mean, this is one, probably, of others. There are others that you already know about, let alone the ones that you don't know about yet. How do you see the future? How are you going to move on as our principal maritime archaeologist?
Well, I think that it's very important that, as a teaching university, we maintain an open field school, an open site on the back of which, rather, we can run a field school. Otherwise, we will continue sending our students abroad. We will continue lacking a site on which we can train both locals and also people that come to us. For example, this year, besides the participants that came through the Honor Frost Foundation, and the two participants came, one was from Lebanon, the other one was from Tunisia, we also had an Erasmus student from the University of Southampton participating with us. So this is University of Southampton. He's doing a Master's in Maritime Archaeology in one of the top schools in maritime archaeology in the world, and he actually came for his experience with us, which is brilliant. So I feel that maintaining an excavation throughout the years is important. We had the same from a terrestrial context, whereby our department used Tassilj and then subsequently the Zeytun excavation to train our students on land. The idea to take this forward, I think we have at least another 2 years in Melleha, and then we have identified a possible further site, again with similar research questions but in a different context. So it's not a question of just going up, opening holes here, there and everywhere just for the sake of it, but rather systematically excavating sites and then moving on to the other, and keeping educational and research requirements sort of on par with each other.
Thank you very, very much. We've come to the end of our time. Thank you, Dr. Timothy Gambin, for coming to talk to us about the Summer School in Maritime Archaeology, which was held this year, and also in general about maritime archaeology and the potential here in Malta. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to University Matters on Campus FM. I hope you'll join us again next week. This is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.